Good morning and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM because it is a Thursday and we're so glad that you could join the conversation. And I'm Tom Flanagan. We appreciate you being at the other end of the radio waves. And if you would like to be at the other end of the telephone line, that number is 850-414-1234. If you got old-fashioned landline, long-distance type connection, it's 800-926-8809. Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email, or you can tweet us at WFSU. Perspective. Boy, I tell you, this morning was looking at the news feed. I was getting ready to come in here to the station, and I noticed that the Palm Beach Post had just put out a bombshell of an investigative piece. It showed how some 10 years ago, the state of Florida essentially fueled America's opioid addiction almost single-handedly, at least for that part of the country east of the Mississippi. And when state officials really got their stuff together and they shut down all the pill mills in Central and South Florida that had been supplying the drugs to so many people, the heroin dealers suddenly moved in to meet that demand. And this is not just in Florida. This was along Arkansas, Kentucky, into North Carolina, South Carolina, primarily in the southeastern part of the country. And even though our part of the state here in North Florida, the Big Bend area, seemed to escape the most severe problem that was seen in so many other communities, North Florida is by no means immune. I was checking something else this morning. The healthcare information firm Castlight published a report a little while back that showed two of the top 25 U.S. cities for opioid addiction were in Florida. Pensacola ranked 6th in the national rankings. Panama City ranked number 3. That's in per capita situation. So it is, if not here, sure close. This is what we're going to talk about this morning. And again, you're invited to be part of that conversation, too. Let's go around the table. We'll introduce our panel. First, Mike Watkins from Big Bend Community-Based Care. Good to see you, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And from law enforcement, we have Captain Ed Cook. Hey, he supervises the Criminal Investigations and Homeland Security Division for the Leon County Sheriff's Office. Ed, good to see you, sir.
Good morning. Also glad to be here.
All right. From our friends at Disc Village, we say hi to Jordan Corwart. Hey, Jordan. Good to see you.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
And sort of the mistress of ceremonies here, Ellen Thickowitz, FSU College of Social Work, and kind of the lead organizer of this whole thing. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, let's talk about the genesis of this whole panel here and how you you put that together, Ms. Pickle-Kavich. Sorry about that. Where did this idea come from in your mind, Ellen?
Well, it was in the news. As we all know, we all have listened to radio, read newspapers that this epidemic, this opioid epidemic, is upon us as a nation. And I, at FSU, wanted to highlight some of the important research that is going on at FSU regarding opioid addiction as well as substance abuse addiction. So we did sponsor a education and research panel in May. We had over 70 people from FSU as well as the community to hear about that research and the topic. Then I felt that it was something, because we ran out of time, quite frankly, to cover all of the important issues, that I really wanted to more broadly speak to the community about what are the options for prevention, for intervention and treatment for opioid abuse, as well as just in general substance abuse treatment.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the scope of the problem, at least here in our area. As we mentioned at the outset, it is certainly worse elsewhere. And Captain Ed, if I could ask you from the law enforcement perspective there, are we seeing a lot of street drugs when it comes to opioids, whether prescription, heroin, that sort of thing here, or have we kind of dodged that bullet?
We have definitely dodged it and seen a decrease over the last probably 5 years. 10 years ago was a lot more common with the pills especially. Traditionally, we've not had a heroin problem here. Lately, we've seen some very, very small seizures of heroin, fentanyl. very, very minimal pill cases at this point. I think with the tackling the pill mill issue and some legislation with some pretty stiff penalties for trafficking in the opioids has definitely helped. So we see very, very few cases anymore involving doctor shopping or any of that type of abuse. No doubt there's still some stuff going on behind closed doors, but as far as on the street, we really aren't having to put too many resources towards that, those investigations.
Well, that's really the good news. But you did mention behind closed doors, and that seems to be especially Jordan, let's talk about your situation at Disc Village. What are you seeing as far as the clientele that comes to you guys? And for the benefit of folks who may not know what Disc Village is, maybe talk about that for a second, too.
Sure, I'll start there. So Disc Village is a substance abuse community-based agency. We've been around for about 40 years. We provide residential treatment and outpatient treatment, particularly in Leon County, but we also serve the surrounding outlying counties as well. So over the past couple of years, we've dedicated some resources and funds to serving opiate-diagnosed clients that have that dependence on that drug. And we've seen an increase in the number of clients that we are able to serve through medication-assisted treatment. You'll hear me bring that term up, but what that means is we're using the assistance of medications in conjunction with the counseling. And that really has a positive impact both in the residential setting and the outpatient setting.
Okay. So as far as your clientele is concerned, how widespread is opioid abuse in amongst that core group that you guys serve?
Well, like Ed said, you know, we're not seeing a tremendous increase. But we are seeing some individual cases that are either whether it's maybe heroin or maybe it is prescription opiates. But a lot of it is polysubstance use. So it's not just one in particular substance. It's mingled with some alcohol. Maybe it's some cocaine. Maybe it's marijuana. And what you're not hearing in the news media is that the large portion of the opioid-related deaths include benzodiazepines, which is a very dangerous combo, and you're not hearing that message out on the news waves. And I can't tell you what the reason for that is, primarily because opiates is the large driver to this. But when you look statewide and you have 14 people a day in Florida dying from opiate use, I would say 80 to 90% of that, those deaths are in maybe included with benzos. So
okay, and what is the street name for that? If I go out on, you know, does the corner, do I say, hey, you got some benzodiazepine
right. So,
here?
Yeah, so the medication would be Xanax. So that's a very popular medication that clients are, you know, some people are using with an opiate.
And so you got a kind of mix and match syndrome going on.
You do, and you have, you know, on the youth level, you have some transitional age youth. I'll say that from 18 to 25, that they're bringing medications in, throwing them in a bowl, and they're just popping pills. You know, reach in a bowl, grab one, and take one. So you got hydrocodone, which is an opiate, and then you have a benzo, that's a Xanax, and so the two could be combined, and you have a very lethal combination there. At the same time, if you go with the heroin track, if you have a heroin user, there's a drug that's called fentanyl that's out on the market. And so fentanyl has a 10-time potency that heroin does. And it takes just a microgram of this fentanyl late mixed in with your heroin, and that is what's triggering some of the overdoses. So when clients come in and they're ODing and they're in the hospital or the detox setting, testing for that fentanyl to see what is actually causing this overdose is very important.
All right. And that is just now almost routinely mixed into some of the street heroin that is showing up in a lot of communities, I hear.
That's right. And you know, when you trace it back, it's coming from overseas. So there's large shipments that are coming in, and the government's working on regulating some of the shipments. And, you know, how do you control that? But It's very hard because once they put out a formulary, then the formula changes. So they're looking at different ways to reduce the potency of specifically fentanyl. And I believe the formula is called acefentanyl, which it isn't as potent, because why would the drug dealers want to kill off their patients that are, you know, fueling that economy? So they're trying to find ways to make it more potent, but not potent enough to, you know, create all the overdoses. So it's definitely an uphill challenge.
Yeah, first rule of successful capitalism, don't kill your customers. Mike Watkins, what are you seeing at Big Bend community-based care?
Well, we're really trying to be the glue in the community across the Big Bend. So we have an 18-county area from Escambia all the way over to Madison-Taylor that we're serving. And we're working directly with law enforcement, EMS, community-based substance use providers like this village to, one, implement the federal grant that Florida has for $27 million statewide. That number is a lot of money, but when you start spreading it across this epidemic, and a lot of people are saying pandemic because it's multiple populations, certainly in this country and multiple states, it's pretty thin. It's a pretty thin set of resources to try to get to the problem. I'm happy to hear that in Leon County that we're having so few instances in Rise, but you mentioned Pensacola and Panama City earlier, and I would add in Fort Walton. EMS there are routinely responding to 24 overdoses a day. In some cases with drugs like this, because of the effectiveness of Narcan, people can recover from an overdose and use an overdose again on the same day. So one of our primary missions is to help educate the community about the effects. I will tell you that a lot of the drugs that are in this class are considered by some people as being okay because they came from a doctor. And they're derived from a prescription. And while some of the rules have changed and around, you know, what can be prescribed and how many, it's still readily available in most cabinets in our community. And I think when young people and adults as well see that label with CVS or Publix stamped on it, they think, you know, it's okay, that it's something that's being regulated, it's something that I can use casually, which we know is not the case.
We're talking about opioids here on Perspectives, and you're always welcome to be part of the conversation at 850-414-1234. You can also email us perspectives at WFSU.org. And Dr. Donna, you hang on the line. You'll be first in line when we come back on the other side of this break right here on Perspectives. Perspectives talking about opioids, a crisis that luckily has not struck the greater Tallahassee area with the intensity that it has elsewhere. But we're still talking about trying to get ahead of that curve if we possibly can with Mike Watkins with Big Bend Community-Based Care, Jordan Corwart from Disc Village, Captain Ed Cook with the Leon County Sheriff's Department, and Ellen Pickle-Kavich from the FSU College of Social Work. And we are joined by Dr. Donna on line one. Thank you so much for your patience, Don. Welcome to Perspective.
Hi, good morning. Hello to your guests. I've been treating chronic pain in Tallahassee area for 40 years now with mental health techniques. And things have changed over the years. And what we're left with now is 8 out of 10 Floridians with undertreated or non-treated chronic pain, which has created another kind of situation. And I'm feeling, 8 to 10 calls a day from people say, you know, my doctor has dismissed me. I had surgery, but now nobody will take over my pain management, and on it goes. And so we've just got ourselves in a pickle of managing people with legitimate pain concerns and issues, and they'd like to be able to get well and get back to work and support their families. And they're hitting this wall of resistance, and of course I'm familiar with the laws that now keep all but 5 categories of specialists from even prescribing pain relievers to people with chronic pain. And here in the Tallahassee area, that boils down to, like, practically nobody is prescribing. So sometimes when people will call and say, you know, I'm bringing my aunt down from Connecticut who's got bad arthritis, and we're going to help take care of her, and we're trying to do the legwork, get her set up with doctors before she gets here, and your name's on the list, then what do we do? And I frankly say she would be better off in Connecticut, because there's just not much possibility of help here. And I do caution my patients not to be angry with their caregivers, because it's not their fault that these loved ones have passed that ties their hands so much. And I'm, of course, sensitive to addiction, because I sure treat, you know, people with addiction. So, but it's a fine line, and I think we've just, that pendulum has really swung too far, and now it's caught up people with severe anxiety disorders, that they're left with very few tools in the medicine cabinet to help with severe cases of anxiety. So maybe you need to discuss what alternatives people may have that have legitimate chronic pain and disorders that would like to get on with their lives and keep working and be productive members of society.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Donna, for your input on that, because that seems like that is the pendulum. And Ellen, we chatted a little bit about that out in the lobby before the program. At one time, that proliferation of pain, so-called pain clinics, I don't know if we want to dignify them with that actual title, that were running essentially illicitly in usually South Florida. Gosh, you could drive down the turnpike or I-75, and that's all you saw were billboards for pain management clinics, and those folks were handing this stuff out by the hundreds. Now we have laws that, as Dr. Donna said, what, you have maybe 2-3 OxyContins that could be prescribed at a time? I think we went through that this year, didn't we, with the legislature?
Correct. And, you know, one of the causes of this opioid epidemic has been the oversupply of those prescription medications compared to other countries. We're 4% of the world's population, but we use 30% of the opioids. So there is chronic pain in Europe. There's chronic pain in Japan. There's chronic pain in China and acute pain, and they are finding ways to deal with those conditions in a more sophisticated way than simply getting a prescription from your doctor. As we all know, we've all had experiences that doctors have very little time, that it is an assembly-like an appointment, that you have very little time to discuss what are your options in terms of different types of treatment and intervention. And I would say that, you know, the oversupply is really shown best in the Centers for Disease Control percentage, the data that shows that 60% of the opioid use in this country, people get it from friends and family, which means that there is an excess in people's medicine cabinets. So that's my message today, is really don't let you know, your friends or family members have your excess opioid medications, and there is a proper disposal of that medication that you should use as soon as you are no longer needing that medication.
Yeah, Jordan, go ahead.
Well, to get a little more specific on what Ellen was talking about, I have some information that's shows the progress that we've made since 2010, and the big push has been the PDMP, the prescription drug monitoring program that the state of Florida has imposed. But back in 2010, there were 900 unregulated pain management clinics. And of the top 50 prescribing physicians across the country, 49 were in Florida. And that is over, and of those 49, that's over 1 million pills per month that they prescribed. So that is why the CDC labeled Florida as the pill mill industry. And so the big push that I think the legislature is working on is how do we regulate this? And the biggest thing is, you know, there's a multifaceted approach, and part of it is trying to limit the supply. The other part is the law enforcement aspect of it. And then the other portion is the treatment component. So offering additional access points to treatment for people that have an issue, limiting and the amount of pills that people have access to. And then on the law enforcement side, they're looking at different ways that they prosecute these charges and how that affects the local community as well. So on a physician level, I know we've locally on the prevention side, we're making an effort to get in front of the physicians through the local medical chapters, the primary care physician associations. There's a local group that's meeting under the mental health coalition structure and trying to figure out what's the information that we want to get out to hospitals and emergency departments and pain management clinic doctors about where to go to get help, where can clients go to take family members if maybe they're no longer being served by a pain management doctor. So there are options out there, and Disc Village is one of those community-based providers that were able to help some of those patients.
Oh, you mentioned law enforcement. So, Captain Ed, let's just say a routine traffic stop that one of the deputies has, and there is we no longer need probable cause. You have reasonable suspicion that there may be something in that vehicle, and you obtain the consent of the driver to check it out. And you have a little bottle of, let's say, hydrocodone, which has a name on it that is not the name of the driver. Right. What happens?
Basically, they go to jail for possessing it without having a prescription. Obviously, you would take some time to do a little research and through interview, who is the person on the prescription? Why are you in possession of it? There may be valid reasons. You know, it could be a spouse or
I picked it up from a mama.
Right, somebody else could have left it in the vehicle that, you know, they share in common. Or, you know, obviously we're going to get to the at least what they're offering us as an excuse, basically, before we make the determination on an arrest. But technically it is a felony to possess it without a prescription. So having someone else's in your possession is breaks the law. And we generally, a lot of what we see now is it'll be in a prescription bottle, but it won't have anybody's name on it. Mm-hmm. That way they're not tying in a person that may be giving it to them, or if they stole it from a family member or something, it's not dragging them into the legal system or putting them under the microscope.
Okay. So yet you have an arrest and they're processed, they're booked into the detention facility.
Correct.
And then what happens? Is there an evaluation made? Does this person have a substance abuse problem or what happens next?
Yes. They are evaluated by medical staff when they come into the detention facility. If they talk about having an abuse problem, they actually that becomes a referral to Disc Village. If they are going to be incarcerated for any length of time, obviously there's programs offered at the detention facility. As far as the opioid stuff goes, we are in partnership with Disc Village with a program that provides Vivitrol, basically to help overcome the addiction. I think they have to detox for a few days first. That is an option, but it's a voluntary basis. And that is something when they're released from the facility, they also can continue through Disc Village.
All right. Well, I remember hearing about that because it was part of the discussion that the legislature had this past year. There was a danger that I think the House budget did not continue funding the Vivitrol program. And for the benefit of folks who don't know, Jordan, you want to, what the heck is that stuff?
Well, so Vivitrol is a fairly new medication that's out on the market, and it's an injectable agonist that binds to the receptors in the brain that helps reduce the cravings of someone who has been taking opiates. So it's very effective. It's non-addictive. It stays in the system for 30 days, and it's just one option that's available through MAT clinics or available through a physician's order as well. So it has some very successful outcomes when you couple that with treatment, if the person needs treatment as well. But, there's a co-occurring issue that I don't think we've talked about, and that mental health plays into this as well, because an individual could be using as to offset that mental health condition. So it's really important that you try to treat the whole person and understand why are they using, what are the underlying issues, is there trauma involved, is there a reason that's leading to their criminal behavior. And so that's where it's really I'm glad we're having this conversation and we have law enforcement and providers at the same table, because the community, in order to make a difference, is going to take all the stakeholders coming to the table and pitching in and really doing a lot of good work together to help the people of our community.
Okay, so Mike Watkins, that collaboration is kind of, again, what you and community-based cares of Big Bend, that you're the ringmaster of all this stuff. You have to pull all this holistic approach together then.
Well, I think we do play an important role, and that's probably going to vary community by community based on who the players are in each of these organizations. I will tell you that if we had any storm that was killing 15 people a day, I think there would be a different response, both from a resource standpoint and from a coordination and public expectation standpoint. So here we are having all of those deaths every day after day after day. And I have urged publicly that we adopt an emergency operations approach. And I think that's the most effective collaboration approach that we have in our community that function very, very well, both at the state and community level. We've recently seen Sheriff Smith down in Franklin County do an excellent job responding to an emergency situation there with the wildfire. That's the kind of approach where you have multiple agencies in the community coming together to respond to the people's needs. And I'd like to see us adopt that kind of approach. It doesn't mean that we literally go into the emergency operations center and turn on the lights, but there needs to be, in my opinion, a formal constitution of an emergency response where there is clear roles and delineation of who has what responsibilities.
And getting in front of that, Ellen, you were saying before, if you're more proactive and you don't have to wait until someone is in that essentially fatal spiral to pull them back.
Right. And I think we have a good example with tobacco. We used at a quite high level in the United States, and now we're at fairly low levels. And part of that was because of the tobacco lawsuit and settlement that infused a large amount of funding into tobacco cessation and tobacco prevention. It's an extremely successful public health model that I think is applicable to many substances, including opioids. So I'd like to see us as a state, as a community, as a country, really focus on the lessons that we learned through that tobacco settlement.
I was just going to say that, and speaking with Senator Monford during session about this, because it was a very much in the center of the table discussion in this session up until the Parkland shooting. Opioids was taking up a lot of time on both chambers. And people have asked, including Senator Monford, what do we have to do? And it's all of it, unfortunately. And I know that's not the answer that people want to hear. But as Ellen has rightfully pointed out, the prevention and education component, both for our youth and our adults, because it's a relatively new phenomenon that, that this can be this problematic for you physically and mentally, coupled with the treatment that Jordan's talking about, coupled with the interdiction that the captain's talking about. That's the kind of coordinated community approach that I was referring to when I said when we have an emergency kind of response.
Yeah, and you're dealing, though, interestingly, with multiple demographics on this front, too.
Yes.
Whereas with some of the other street drugs and all, that this is, and you said that before, Jordan, the kids get out and here is the grab bag of goodies in the middle of the party table and
right.
Everyone avails themselves with, potentially lethal substances. But you've got so many folks who either coming off of cancer surgery or some major dental procedure or something in which legitimately they get a prescription for an opioid derivative pain management substance and go off the rails. and they may be in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. How do you deal with that population?
Well, I think you have to take that prevention approach, and it does address the younger demographic. So that's where the prevention efforts in the school system are very targeted, and they address the opioid use. And then you take a different approach with your middle-age group, and what are the ways that they engage, you know, social media campaigns, getting the information out there as far as, you know, what are the options, what are the side effects, what to look for, the signs and symptoms. That education is crucial, that Ellen talked about. And then, you know, to your older demographic, you want to coordinate with the doctors, because that's the group that's seeing the doctors going in and having the issues. And so there's historically you have the primary care and behavioral care haven't really commingled, so to speak. So there's a lot of opportunities going forward to share information and talk about what the best ways to treat these types of signs and symptoms that are in the best need, that are in the essentially the best for the patient.
Okay. And Ellen, hold that thought here for just a sec. We got a break up and coming here talking about opioid crisis and perhaps not quite a crisis in our area, which is the good news. However, we want to hear your story, and you can add to that by giving us a call at 850-414-1234 or drop us an email, perspectives@wfsu.org, and we'll be right back. Perspectives. And a reminder, you can always find the show online at WFSU.org. Go to that address and click on radio, pull down the programs menu, and boing, there comes Perspectives right at you. You can click on that because we archive past shows usually within 24 hours of when they appear on your radio, so you can go back and listen to them at your leisure again and again and again. Ellen Pickle-Kavich, you were just about to jump into something here that Jordan had referenced before we went into break.
Well, it's really back to one of the things that we can do to help decrease the supply. And Allied Against Opioid Abuse was a coalition that we work with that really highlights this issue of safe disposal. And there are kits that people can use to do that. Please do not flush your medications down the toilet. We want to make sure that our water supply is free of these medications, and this would be of any medications, not just opioid. But if you do not have access to one of these kits, there are collection sites at the Tallahassee Police Department, and also you can do your own kit at home. Take your prescription pill container, fill it with kitty litter, and pour a little water in it and put duct tape around it. Please remove your name from the label and put duct tape around it and throw it in the trash. So that will neutralize the medication and make it safe for disposal. So that's just a at-home remedy and option, and I strongly recommend it because, as we have said, parents out there, please be aware, grandparents, be aware out there, that your 18 to 25-year-old grandkids or even younger know about these medications. A survey of college-age students found that they responded that opioid medications were very, very easy to acquire. 11% reported that they are taking pills that they don't know what they are. So responding back to Jordan's comment about the parties that they have where there's a bowl of medication. So that's where some of these medications are ending up, and in some cases, tragic consequences. One last thing I would say about locally is that I know that many people on the phone have lost family members to overdoses. It may not be an epidemic in Tallahassee, but it's 1 degree of separation. I personally know two people that have lost someone to an overdose, And so it is impacting us in different ways, maybe by just knowing somebody or having a family member who has passed away.
Okay. And Mike Watkins, as you said, people would not avail themselves of this if it did not work.
Yeah, they're very good. You know, we have a long history of opiate use in this country. We certainly have come to a kind of a crescendo now. Hopefully we can, deter that in some way through these strategies. But they work for people, and that's why they're being prescribed. And the manufacturers knew that. The distributors knew that. They knew that they were spending those 1 million pills in the state of Florida. And for that reason, I will tell you that our group has sued Big Pharma in federal court. So we have been referred to the MDL, which is multi-district litigation in Cleveland, Ohio. So Judge Polster is hearing that case. By last count, there's more than 500 lawsuits that's in that group that the judge will be sorting out, hopefully this year, because we know that it's cost our community a great deal, both in terms of the human toll, resources from the community and policing and healthcare, and also the treatment. We're staring down at least two generations of addiction that we're going to have to overcome in our best way. We have numerous thousands of kids have come into the Florida's foster care system because of their parents either dying or being addicted. So the costs are very, very high. We think that the people responsible for producing these drugs and marketing them very aggressively when they knew they have addictive properties and said that they did not should be at the table and trying to help turn this around.
Captain Ed, maybe this is more effective coming from you than anyone else. One attitude that is probably much more widespread than the individual who articulated it to me said that, well, when it comes to this sort of thing, it is a self-solving problem. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He says, well, the individuals who don't exercise personal responsibility allow themselves to get hooked on this stuff. They either die or just wind up in prison, and that's what should happen.
Definitely have to disagree with that mentality. Even the ones that do end up incarcerated, you know, obviously the goal is to help them and allow them to get back into society and not be addicted. And hopefully that can help lead to not committing crime and everything else if that's part of the reason they're doing it. Because that actually is a takeaway from the pills, but a lot of drug abuse in general, not just opioids, I mean, that leads to crime, because people need money to buy the drugs so they commit the crime. So it kind of hurts us overall. So I think really the push these days in law enforcement is definitely not just to lock people up that have substance abuse problems, but it's to educate, to help resolve the issues, why they're on them to begin with, and to hopefully they'll become good members of society upon release and can continue treatment through places like Dis Village when they are released. It's really the goal now. We've even gone to the extent of all our deputies over their in-car computers have access to a program called Spirit, where if they are talking to someone in the community, doesn't have to be anybody under arrest, just talking to anybody, and they say, you know, oh, I have an opioid problem, they can go in the computer, pull up any of our providers that have signed up that offer services for substance abuse, or it could be opioid specific. They enter that person's name. It sends it to those providers or the provider that the person wants it sent to. That provider contacts that person directly and gets law enforcement out of the middle of it. So we're kind of the middleman to try to set them up with a treatment program, but then can step back. Because a lot of people, you know, the more they deal with law enforcement, the more you worry about the appearance or you know, worrying about going to jail type stuff. So I think the Spirit program is something that we're doing to try to keep people out of the system up front.
Interestingly, one substance that used to be a trigger for law enforcement is now moving into kind of a different role. Mitchell posts from Facebook. He wanted to know, what role does marijuana have on pain management now that there is, in fact, legalized medical marijuana in the state of Florida? Does it have efficacy? Does it work? Ellen, what do you think?
Well, there is some promising research coming out of Colorado that shows that that potentially medical marijuana has some benefit in treating pain, but also researchers have found that for mild and medium level of pain, that over-the-counter medications work, Tylenol, Advil. So if people would perhaps, if they have dental surgery, minor dental surgery, please try some of these other options before you maybe leap into starting an opioid, particularly if you are a parent and your child is having wisdom teeth out, maybe consider some other medication. So there are options out there, but the research on marijuana is still very early days, and we don't want to substitute one substance for another. Opioids are currently the substance du jour that we are afraid of, but as we all have around this table seen, alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, meth, they're still out there as well. And substance abuse really is the key issue, and we want to not lose sight of the fact that we want to be treating substance abuse in general, because today it's opioid, and tomorrow it'll be something else that we haven't even thought of, perhaps.
Well, this has been endemic, I guess, to people kind, as long as there have been people, that we're looking for ways to reduce pain, to mitigate depression, to all these other things. But let me just throw this out here. Do you think it's gotten worse, that maybe we have a lower tolerance, a lower threshold for, just life than maybe we used to?
Yeah. Well, Tom, I'm 48, and I will just tell you, in my lifetime, I've never seen anything that's killing 15 people a day in our state. I think this is, once-in-a-lifetime kind of epidemic that really requires our attention, that I don't see enough resources and attention being paid to.
Yeah, because if anything, you said it before, if anything else killed 15 people a day in our state, we'd be going crazy.
We would. And tragedy is tragedy, and human loss is human loss. And I will tell you, there's some really compelling stories out there. Commissioner Pam Fiegel out in Taylor County, she lost her adult son, and she's now raising her grandkids from this addiction. And there's just some really heart-wrenching stories out there. I understand the idea that, people need to help themselves and not use, that kind of thing. But in most instances, what we're finding is at this level, they need professional help, and the stakes are very high. And it's not just the user. It's the community that may be the victim of theft, from a neighbor or community person. It's the grandparent. It's the parent. It's siblings and spouses. This is a widespread effect, and I will tell you, it's a huge ripple around that person that has this level of addiction.
Yeah, we all get to pay for it. That's the other thing. And Jordan, is there hope with the tools that are available, be it Vivitrol, counseling, treatment, law enforcement understanding now, all of these other holistic type of resources? Can you say, hey, we can at least make a move towards fixing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's not just going to happen overnight. It's going to be a long-term approach, like Mike was saying, probably about two generations that we're looking at. But it starts with prevention and education. It starts trying to change that stigma that addiction is something you can just drop in a day and choose not to do. Addiction is a disease, and trying to educate people on what that actually means. It's compared to high blood pressure. So you take a medication for your high blood pressure. It's the same thing for an addiction too. And now there's actually some legitimate medications that are out there. Methadone has been around for a long time. And the people that are on methadone are highly functioning, productive citizens of society. And the stigma that's around these medications, the other one is buprenorphine. So Suboxone is another prescription name for that drug. And then Vivitrol, both of these are, somebody could walk up to you and they're on this medication, you would never know. And they can hold a job, they pay taxes, they have a house payment, their kids go to school with your kids. And it's trying to educate our community members and the stakeholders that make these decisions as far as criminal justice, child welfare, and substance abuse. It's all interrelated. So I think the options that we do have, we need to expand the access for more people, and that comes with additional resources to be able to provide this type of treatment to those who need it.
And if you personally know somebody who is having this kind of a situation, don't be afraid to not get in their face and intervene that way. But Ellen, what's the best course of action? I know, you know, a loved one, a friend that I think is going through this thing. What should I do?
Well, and I did want to say that, you know, one of the best places for intervention is in our, you know, emergency rooms. Once somebody has been hospitalized because of an overdose, it is when they are the most vulnerable for another overdose, which they will die from. So there's an incredible opportunity if you're a family member that has somebody that has been hospitalized. You know, that is the most critical and crucial time to try to get them into treatment. And I want to make sure that people do their due diligence in choosing a treatment option and treatment center that is reputable. There are now many of these addiction treatment centers that have nice ads on television and in magazines that look very pretty, and they make these great promises. So please do your due diligence in making sure that the facility is accredited and that you do not place your loved one in a place that will not do them any good. So there are options in Tallahassee, such as Disc Village, that are highly reputable. This is a complex issue. Addictions are a complex issue. Chronic pain is a complex issue that we talked about this morning. That there could be many, many reasons for the addiction. So please make sure that it's not just treatment; it's quality treatment.
Just like there used to be all kinds of so-called reputable clinics that said they could solve your pain problems.
Correct.
No muss, no fuss. Have a couple hundred. Now, let's see if Kelsey can join us here online, too. Thanks for hanging on, Kelsey. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that many people here in Florida have found relief from medical marijuana, and to not associate it with the opioid crisis like this is a gateway drug to opioids. So I just wanted to point out that the medical marijuana law is helping a lot of people here in Florida.
Thanks so much, Kelsey. Really appreciate you bringing that in. And again, we do have medical marijuana in Florida, which who could have thunk that 30 years ago? Captain Ed, you remember, you've been at the SO for a long time. Could you even imagine that when you first joined the department?
No, not at all, because my whole career was basically, that was a gateway drug. I mean, I think we were taught that in the academy, that, you know, that's how it starts. And so the fact that it's gotten where it is now is definitely a total opposite of what I expected.
Yeah, changing times, that's for sure. But the hopeful sign is, and Mike, you can kick in here again with the whole holistic approach here, the collaborative, the coalitional type of response to this type of thing. I think we can keep ahead of it?
I'm an optimist. I think we can do better. And we have lots of good partners in our community, the sheriffs, the courts. We do have a drug court program in Leon County. And the court staff have been, and the judges have been great, chief judge at helping implement that. So great community-based providers, the universities, I think, probably play a great role. And just the economics of our community is strong. And because of that, I think that's probably one of the factors in us having a lower incident rate right here in Tallahassee. But as you move away from that epicenter, the economic picture changes. And probably drives, more drug use the further we get out, where there's less resources and less opportunity. And I think that's where coordination becomes even more important when we get in the rural communities, that we have some strong working relationships and we understand the consequences of what the people are going through.
Yeah, and the fact that those resources are not as immediately available to those folks out in the hinterland as they are right here in a larger metropolitan area, where you just run down the street and you've got, whether it's, you know, Disc Village, or you have a law enforcement officer going by and you need to flag them down or whatever. Folks, it's been a wonderful discussion today, and I really appreciate everyone coming in and addressing that. So to Mike Watkins from Big Bend Community-Based Care, Jordan Corwart from Disc Village, Captain Ed Cook from the Leon County Sheriff's Office, and Ellen Pickle-Kavich, which is the FSU College of Social Work. Thank you all for being on Perspectives today. Perspectives produced by WFSU in Tallahassee. Technical assistance today, Taylor Cox pushing all the buttons and Lydell Rawls on the interconnections. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Suddenly, in the wake of the devastating East Point wildfire that Mike Watkins referenced earlier in the program, everyone's talking about prescribed burns and the one that went awry down in Franklin County earlier this week. Our expert panel will talk about that and include you in the conversation coming up next week right here on Perspectives.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.